helped us find many customers.
Since the U.S. withdrawal from the 2015 deal and reimposition of sanctions on Iran in 2018, Tehran has doubled down on its efforts to wean its economy off the ups and downs of politics. While the Iranian government still pursues diplomatic channels with the West, it capitalizes more on domestic production, as it believes this will shield the economy against foreign pressures.
Local brands here say the United States measures have given domestic production a boost in Iran. As they say, the government has made a strategic shift toward an economy that's driven by Made in Iran products. Yusuf Jalali, Press TV, Tehran.
The United Nations Assistance Mission in Afghanistan has called on the Taliban to safeguard the basic rights of Afghans, especially those of women and girls. The mission said Taliban's edicts and orders in many cases have violated or impinged on the basic rights and freedoms of the population.
The United Nations in Afghanistan is urging the de facto authorities to stop restricting the basic rights of Afghans, especially those of women and girls, because those who govern have an immense responsibility as duty bearers to every woman, man, girl, and boy.
In reaction, the Taliban deputy spokesman said the so-called Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan has been committed to ensuring the rights of all Afghans. Bilal Karimi also dismissed the UN mission's stance as unreasonable.
We are committed to upholding human rights on the principles of Islamic law, but the statements published by foreigners can have two reasons. Either they're not aware of our culture and Islamic society, or they neglect our Afghan and Islamic values for political motivations. However, they literally don't care about human rights, but they have problems with Islam and implementation of Islamic orders. Such remarks by them are unjustifiable. Actually, our people did not fight invaders for decades to see Western patterns being practiced in their society.
Human rights activists say the Taliban need to be more flexible and supportive when it comes to the human rights of the Afghan people.
Of course, Afghans are Muslims and have their own culture, but the Taliban should not force people to practice religion according to their point of view. The Taliban are depriving the people of their very fundamental rights. Most of their orders on women are against the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, to which Afghanistan was a signatory.
Serious violations of the rights of women and girls by the Taliban, including the right to education, have added insult to injury caused by the U.S. sanctions on Afghanistan and their impact on the human rights situation in the country. The global community has so far refused to recognize the Taliban government in Afghanistan. Upholding human rights by the de facto administration is mentioned as one of the conditions for the recognition. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Like other parts of the Muslim world, Islam's faithful followers in Pakistan also observed the martyrdom anniversary of Hazrat Fatima Zahra, the revered daughter of Prophet Muhammad. People from all walks of life attended mourning ceremonies in different cities and towns across the country to pay tribute to Hazrat Fatima Zahra, who is also the wife of the first Shia Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib. The mourning ceremonies included reciting verses from the Holy Quran, congregational prayers, and lectures on the life and sacrifices of the daughter of Islam's last prophet. While highlighting the valuable contributions of Islam's greatest lady, religious scholars said Fatima Zahra is one of the five holy ladies in the history of the world and has a very high position in Islam.
When we say that Fatima Zahra is a role model, we do not mean that this is the only limited to a few areas of her life. This discussion is endless and we can never stop discussing the greatness of her personality.
Fatima Zahra is a shining example not only for women but every Muslim. She cemented the guidance and teaching which Islam brought and showed us that they are possible to implement in our daily lives.
Some mourners also gave away food to the people in need to mark the occasion. They say that helping others in need is the lesson given to all Muslims by the Prophet Muhammad and his household.
We organize ceremonies every year to pay tribute to Hazrat Fatima Zahra. Distributing food is a custom of the Prophet's household, which is to be followed by their faithful followers.
Iran, Iraq, and Lebanon are among the other Muslim countries marking the martyrdom anniversary of Hazrat Fatima Zahra.
While honoring her immense sacrifices and services in the path of Islam, participants in the ceremonies described Fatima Zahra as the best role model, not only for the Muslims, but for the followers of all religions. Nasir Kazmi in Islamabad.
The EU started out as a peace project. Some lawmakers say the bloc is becoming more authoritarian. A meeting of justice ministers on Friday heard at least €300 billion worth of Russian assets inside the EU have been frozen since March.
There are 1,359 individuals and companies on our sanctions list with assets and financial resources all over the EU. We cannot let anything slip through the net.
With even more sanctions on the way for Moscow, EU officials are now using torture analogies.
Every time that there is a need, we turn the screw further.
But at what price? The EU's energy sanctions targeting Russia are strangling the bloc's economy. Rents and mortgages are rising steadily. Young people in precarious jobs are at greatest risk.
Very, very bad. Really bad. It's like everybody knows somebody that lose a job, that lose that is their people losing houses, families losing houses.
It's quite depressing for us to think that, for example, as for me, I'm studying a degree and I'm nearly certain that I'm not going to find a job when I'm done with it.
EU social affairs ministers met here in Brussels on Friday.
Many people, many households are facing difficult moments and we should leave nobody behind.
Charities say it's already too late for many and words need to be replaced by actions. At the same time, the EU is able to send billions of euro to the Ukrainian army and government. We do not hear anything about peace negotiations. Instead, EU leaders will meet here next Thursday to agree on more funding for Ukraine's army. On the same day, the European Central Bank will announce interest rates are to go up further. Critics say that priorities are all wrong. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
On Saturday, a string of anti-system parties labelled by the Italian media as the Forces of Dissent gathered in Rome to discuss the challenges being faced by Italy and the EU and future strategies. The meeting was attended by political groups including More Sovereign and Popular Italy, Reclaim Italy, an alternative, formations advocating for the protection of Italy's sovereign interests and for shielding a growing number of Italians who are paying a heavy toll to what they call a dictatorship of neoliberalism.
In short, we are under a dictatorship, a regime that has stripped us all of dignity, rights. We can't get decent jobs anymore. Our constitution has been vilified. Our youngest generations have been taught the wrong values.
Independent journalists and geopolitical analysts also attended the meeting. They slammed the EU for its vulnerability to corruption and NATO for its belligerent posture. They also argued that the energy crisis was purposely triggered to favor the energy giants and their shareholders.
NATO is primarily responsible for what's happening in Ukraine. A long-planned operation, which has also involved the U.S. secret services since the 2014 coup in Ukraine. We believe nations should reclaim their sovereignty and be free to strengthen ties with any country they want.
This affection for politics is running wild in Italy. The turnout for last September's general elections was about 64%, the lowest ever recorded, 9% down compared to the 2018 vote.
Our party was boycotted when we ran in the elections last September. The Italian media simply ignored us. Furthermore, about 4 out of 10 Italians did not vote, meaning that the current parliament only partially represents the will of the people.
Following the outcome of Italy's latest elections held in September, which saw a right-wing coalition led by Giorgia Meloni emerging as winners, all anti-system parties have remained out of the parliament. The once anti-establishment five-star movement managed to garner 18% of the votes, but its section in the parliament seemed to have lost both power and potential now that the party has moved towards more moderate stances. Max Civili, Rome.
Since the riots began in September, anti-Iran media has been depicting the situation as a violent crackdown on so-called peaceful protesters. For the past 2 months, they have been running a propaganda campaign to further pressure Iran under the pretext of violating human rights. But are these peaceful protesters? Iran's intelligence ministry has recently reported the confiscation of huge cache of weapons and equipment used by terrorists. In fact, Iranian security forces have thwarted several arms smuggling operations and dismantled a number of operational cells affiliated with the terrorist organizations such as MKO. This comes as the illegal influx of weapons into the country is on the rise recently. The confiscated weapons were supposed to be transferred to Iran to be used in the recent riots. Last month, in an interview with the Persian service of the British state-funded broadcaster BBC, former White House National Security Advisor John Bolton said the, quote, Iranian opposition is now being armed with weapons. Bolton added that these arms are being smuggled into the country from the Iraq's Kurdistan region, praising the use of force against Iran's security forces. The recent foreign-backed riots in Iran have claimed hundreds of lives belonging to both security forces and ordinary people. In addition, by conducting acts of vandalism, violence, and insecurity, rioters have paved the way for separatist and terrorist groups to infiltrate the country and carry out brutal attacks against innocent people.
Smuggling huge amounts of weapons into Iran to be used in the recent foreign-backed unrest is merely aimed at undermining the country's security. But Iranian officials have time and again stated that Iran's security is a red line that no one is allowed to cross. Mahdi Abbasian, Tehran.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
The Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness. And I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change, and that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty wise.
Sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The UK has been plagued by strikes for some time now, the common theme higher pay to keep in pace with inflation. The latest postal worker walkouts coinciding with the busiest time of the year, Christmas. But the pace of the strikes and its range over different sectors is worsening the inflation-hit UK economy. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the dire economic situation of the UK and how the government of Rishi Sunak is trying to deal with it. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of The Spotlight. Seamus Abbas joins us. He's a journalist and political commentator from London. Also joining us is Farah Hughes, journalist, author, and activist from Belfast.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Simwasan Abbas, I will start first with you. Taking a look at the strikes that are happening, obviously a strike is never a good time for it to occur, but this one is surely coming at a time when it's going to affect lots of things, this latest one being by the postal workers. Why is the UK experiencing so many strikes, however, all kind of give or take at the same time?
Essentially because there's been a kind of comedy of disasters instigated by government after government for many years. But more short term, I suppose one could put these things down to things like COVID lockdown, the rising oil prices, you know, the worst cost push inflation since 1970s. More longer term, I suppose, if you looked at the Brexit situation, the general poor productivity of Britain and the decline in competitiveness with a lot of the major trading partners that Britain has, all of this, along with lack of investment in technology, these are standard reasons given by people who say that's why Britain is in the condition it is. But to be fair, you know, it's over the last 13 years, if you just take note of the fact that the actual rise in wages has been in essentially less than 1%, and yet if you looked at price rises and the general cost of living, that's of course shot through the roof. So there's been no parity. So it's no wonder that finally Britain has woken up to the fact that actually they've been mugged by this government, which has been causing economic disasters, whether you'd say those were by accident or whether they were stupidity or whether they were actually engineered and deliberately synchronized. That's something we could explore perhaps as we go along.
Yes, that's lots to explore. Not too sure if our 25 minutes is going to be able to cover that. Now, let me ask you this, Farah Hughes. I'm taking a look at two angles here. One is how, for example, Andrew Griffith, MP, has said these railway strikes are going to keep families apart. They will cost the UK businesses, put pressure on roads, cancel hospital visits, and it will obviously contribute to missed school days. But isn't the bigger picture something that's so much more worse, that it needs any type of action, strikes being one of it, in order to elevate the seriousness of the matter that the UK is dealing in terms of its economy? And basically, at the core of it, at least one of them, is the fact that you're dealing with inflation, of which incomes are not keeping up with it. And so you need something in order to put a check on the government in order for it to do something.
Yes, well, I think the first thing to bear in mind is that people never strike as a first resort. Striking by workers is a last resort. It's a sign of desperation. It's a sign of failure in the kind of arbitration talks between the trade union movement and either the government and or their private employers, whoever is the kind of governing body in employing this particular group or profession. I think if you just... like a very good microcosm of all this would be the fact that the Royal College of Nursing is striking for the first time in its 100-year history. And that speaks volumes for people who train and dedicate their lives, their time, their energy and their empathy to help people who are suffering, to help people who are in need, to save lives and indeed to deliver lives in the maternity units, and to help people, unfortunately, at end of life, maybe through palliative care. So we're talking about a group of professionals who would be seen to be among the most kind of emotionally invested people in society, saying, we have had enough, we have been left with no choice, we must go out on strike. And when we consider how many people died during COVID on the front line as members of the health service, that's not just nurses, that's doctors, that's porters, that's theater technicians, that's x-ray radiologists, that's the whole spectrum within the health service. And we were asked to clap them on a Thursday night for 10 minutes, and they were seen to be the heroes of the NHS in the war against COVID. And now that that war has been won, or perhaps we have seen COVID in its real light for what it really was, now those people are being asked to take a 4% pay raise, which in reality is a 16% pay cut when we look at inflation running at over 11%. And for people to have a pay raise in line with inflation, and actually a pay raise is when you have more money this year than you did last year, that pay raise should be in and around 19%. And one major barometer of society and its ills is homelessness. And I looked earlier, and you know, depending which statistics you follow, there are between 480 and 1,270 registered homeless people died in England and Wales last year. And according to the Big Issue, that is one homeless person died every 7 hours. So this is the failure of the government. The homelessness is a barometer of the economic situations, and I feel things will only get worse. And I would personally like to see a general strike by all workers in the United Kingdom to bring the government to its senses and to pay people a fair day's wage for a fair day's work.
Yeah, there's really no great economic news coming day in and day out, practically. I don't want to exaggerate here, Seamus and Abbas. But taking a look at wages now, because, again, we need to lay out all the different stats in order to get the gravity of the situation and how severe it is. One of them is the fact that you have the wages and that situation in which, from what I'm looking at over here, the average pay rise for workers in the private sector, it came in at just 6.9% between August and October, of which this particular source says that compares to wage growth of just 2.7% for public sector employees, 2.7%. And then you have this headline, and I have to put this next to each other since we don't have that much time, is the fact that you have, this was the Daily Mail that came out with this, where you have the wages to have fallen 3.9%, the fastest rate in 13 years, based on the cost of living crisis. So, again, more bad news. I think the only positive news is that inflation was 11.2% and it came down to 10.9%. I think that was the only positive economic news that I saw. So, basically, again, we're looking at income not keeping up with inflation, and even worse, in this case, if wages to have dropped. What's your understanding of the way that this wage scenario is working out now?
Well, there's been of course, a leaning towards corporate power in Britain ever since Margaret Thatcher, and since she brought in the kind of the power of the corporates and broke essentially the trades unions, the bargaining power of the ordinary worker has been reduced. And of course, with this globalization business, what partly was happening was that if workers, for instance, here in Britain, or if they were in Germany, if we're with the industrialized nations or the technologically advanced nations, if they were to if their workers would say, no, we don't want to do this and we're going to strike and demand more wages, they would say, okay, fine, our corporations are shifting this business, we're taking it off to China, we're going to do an exodus. And that would, of course, then scare the trades unions, and it would also mean that they didn't push the demands for wages too much. That's been one of the major factors. It's this globalization of industry, which allows these corporations to basically shift their business wherever they like. And of course, that's weakened trades unions and the power of the ordinary worker. That hasn't changed, although what's happened with Brexit is interesting, because, you know, Britain not only left the EU, they left the single market, they left the custom union, and that, it said, has accounted for something like 50% reduction of the UK trade overall. And these are all, I suppose, factors which lead to a perfect storm, which has also been consolidated more recently by Britain's rather ridiculous backing of the Americans in the war or in Ukraine against Russia. The truth of the matter is that has been another nail in their own coffins, because of course the energy crisis has kicked in, and that's another reason for rising oil prices, which has created the worst cost push inflation since the 1970s. So nothing was going to really go up in terms of these wages, and at the same time they've been pumping prices up long before even Brexit happened. Things were rising on the shelves anyway, but people kind of were forced to tolerate it. Now, of course, it's got to sort of breaking point. People can feel that the winter is coming in, this threat of supply lines, you know, supply chains for food, the threat of energy prices going through the roof, and general insecurity is now making people belatedly react. Whether it's too little, too late, we're not sure, but certainly, you know, there is a huge problem on the horizon.
Okay. Again, I'm trying to lay the foundation here, and I need as much as is in your ability, both of you, to make us understand, since you are at least in that part of the world, as to how bad the situation is. And Frau Hughes, this particular piece of stat, the source being the New Economics Foundation, I have to mention it because, honestly, there's so many sources out there, and some of them just don't match up. And I don't want to exaggerate, nor do I want to misquote facts, or misrepresent is the word I'm looking for. But this particular one says that projected increases in unemployment would result, based on rising prices or inflation, it would result in 43% of households lacking the resources to put food on the table, buy new clothes, or treat themselves and their families. Now, that's almost half from what I'm understanding here. And then what's worse is that it says it's a 12 percentage point rise compared with 2019. So in 2019, I mean, if my math is correct, you're looking at 31% of households. Now, it was bad, and now it's gotten worse. And that's close to half of households. Do you agree with this stat, first of all? Is it that bad?
Well, I'm going to assume it is, because, I mean, the first thing a government does is manipulate the facts. I mean, there's lies, damn lies, and statistics. And I think the problem with governmental statistics are they are all massaged for public consumption. So let's assume it's true, for starters. I mean, we are all aware of the anecdotal evidence of kids going to school hungry. I mean, with lots and lots of breakfast clubs now where I live, in the schools, and actually some private kind of cafes in the morning offering kids breakfast on their way to school. More and more food banks are prevalent, and you know, I see again, like anecdotal things, like people put up we have a small petrol station and we're leaving out 20 liter drums of home heating oil for whoever needs it. Just turn up, take the heating oil, take it home, put it in your tank. It's not a lot, but it might be people for a few days in a very, very, very cold snap of weather, and bring back the empty container and it'll be filled up again. So there's almost like a seesaw between the people in desperate need and those that are in society who are trying to help, who are actually stepping in to the governmental role. The government should be there if we believe in the basic wage. The idea of the basic wage, it's not a living wage. It's not so people can afford cars or go on holiday or have luxuries. The basic wage is supposed to enable every household within the United Kingdom to live above the poverty line. Also, you have state subsidies in the form of unemployment benefit and universal credit and other home kind of income support finances to prevent all this from happening. And yet, you know, the mortality rate for children is going up, and the life expectancy for adults is going down, and more and more children are falling into the poverty trap. So there's relative poverty and there's absolute poverty. And what you're alluding to is 40% or plus of families and homes and communities and society at large are struggling to meet the basic needs of putting food on the table, putting clothes on the backs of their children, and putting heat and electricity and oil and gas into their homes. And that's why we're seeing these strikes. That's why we're seeing people at the end of their tether. And that's why, if I was a trade union leader, I'd be calling for a general strike.
Well, there's no denying it, and I'm hoping that I'm correct in this, Said Mohsen Abbas. When you take a look at, and we have to take COVID in the context of things, at least for you to do that for us. But there's no denying the fact that before the Ukraine conflict broke out, things didn't look as bad as they are right now. And I'm saying that, of course, your input here is more valuable than whatever I think. I'm putting this, I'm addressing this to you, given the fact that when you take a look at the aid that Ukraine has received, of which out of the 93.8 billion pounds, or euros, I must say, half came from the States, 29.2 billion euros from the European Union, and it says 12.3 billion euros came from other countries, mostly the United Kingdom. So put that into context for us, if you can.
I think the context is fairly fairly obvious from the statistics, and I don't doubt those statistics at all. The British government has embarked on absolutely self-destructive economic policies for such a long time now. Not for the rich, I might add, because, of course, if you were to look up the billionaires index and their profits, they have been rising disproportionately, even in COVID. In fact, there are those of us who argue that basically all of these policies that the British government have instigated or instituted could only be done by absolute saboteurs or traitors to this country, or by complete idiots. The reality of the matter is you send money abroad to a war which you have no profit or gain from, against the main provider of your oil and gas and perhaps even wheat and such like products. At the same time, you've done no investment in building your own energy capabilities. You've done nothing to really try and compensate from pulling out of Brexit, which was a major disaster, the way it was done and the speed at which it was done and the manner of it. There was nothing in place in terms of building British trade alliances globally in that short space of time. It couldn't be done. And, the main trading partners around Europe, of course, are the first ones who've dropped their kind of connections, and there's huge issues surrounding virtually every aspect of that Brexit exit. So COVID and Brexit as a combination, without a doubt, have given Britain a huge hammering. But these were all political decisions. They weren't done in ignorance. The government lied openly and barefacedly. Boris Johnson lied openly during Brexit about how they were going to benefit the NHS and how many billions they were going to be able to save by pulling out of the EU. They were just absolute barefaced lies. And the chicken is going to come home to roost, and it already is. It hasn't even, I think, begun. I think it's going to get a lot worse than it is already. And in a way, this is a political set of blunders. But I would say that the Corporation of London and the people sitting in those in the Bank of England, the people sitting in the Square Mile, the people sitting in Westminster, for me, there seems to be this kind of gross negligence or even collusion to bring Britain to its knees. It was completely unnecessary. It was totally avoidable. You can't blame it on the global downturn all the time. It is also down to the policies that they've deliberately rolled out. They won't affect the elite and the rich. The rich will continue getting richer, but it's the ordinary workers that have indeed on the ground started suffering to the extent where poverty, areas like Burnley, which we've covered before, I think, on the program, where their people are falling below the poverty line, and children are going without lunches, and there will be all sorts of cost cutting. And for a nation which was meant to be the sixth biggest economy in the world, this is an absolute travesty for a nation of this kind of power and economic muscle to be in a state where it's now literally got its population begging for handouts. Food banks all across the country are booming. Many people are desperately going and relying on food banks. So it's not a lie. There is a huge problem caused by the arrogance and the elitism, and perhaps also the coordination with the Great Reset of the World Economic Forum and Klaus Schwab. These governments are hand in glove with a much bigger global agenda to really bring populations to heal and to make people Indeed. Feel like they have to have gratitude for what they're given, even the meager morsels that they're given.
I knew we don't have enough time to cover all the topics. I just have a minute to give to you. And this is really what's shocking here, Frahius. Bank of England, the portfolio is reading £200 billion in the red after UK rout. I don't know if you read this piece of news. Very recent. Now, I don't know what this means exactly as to how you can have the Bank of England be that much in the red. But obviously, the bank, along with the people who are wealthy, something's going on there, which the ordinary people are suffering from what we're looking at in the UK. What needs to be done by Rishi Sunak? I think the best he's had to offer so far, trying to come up with £50 billion in tax revenues. Is that what I'm understanding?
Yes, I think that was seen to be the black hole that was in the financial budget that he was trying to reconnect with. I think we really just have to be honest, and we'll have to be truthful, and we'll have to view reality as it is. The governments and the elite are living in a bubble. They have never cared for working class people. From Margaret Thatcher, we have had nothing but austerity for the guts of 40 years. Rishi Sunak's recent, or Jeremy Hunt's recent budget proves that they are only concerned with putting profit before people, putting the profits of the companies before the welfare of the people. The little people don't matter. The little people, many of them have got to the point now where they no longer even vote. And those who vote sometimes are voting along racist, discriminatory, kind of law and order issues instead of facing up to the reality that until there is a government that is there for the people, then we will continue to drift listlessly into that long good night.
Thank you for that. Sorry to be such a sour note, but we have to deal with reality, and we appreciate both of you, Saeed Mohsin Abbas, journalist and political commentator, and Frahius, thank you, journalist, author, and activist. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Yacoba Tapwe and the team, it's goodbye.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Following the energy crisis and unprecedented inflation in England, the supporting institutions of the UK's National Health Service, NHS, are looking to create warm banks in order to protect the vulnerable individuals of the society against the risk of death due to frostbite or starvation. This is while the head of the British National Health Service had previously warned about the danger to life that the lack of heating systems threatens people in winter. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world press and news agencies to shed more light on the issue. Please stay tuned. The nationalnews.com reports the United Kingdom has set up more than 3,200 warm banks across the country for people who cannot afford to heat up their homes amid cost of living and energy crisis. Operated by local authorities and charities, the areas provide a safe and warm environment for people who are trying to make ends meet. As the bone shivering cold sees temperatures dropping to as low as 10 degrees Celsius. Nora, a jobless woman in her 50s who regularly visits a warming center, said, "We are all struggling with everything, gas, electricity and food. Until a year ago, I could get by on benefits." Retired Brian, 65, said his energy bill has tripled from £80 a month. At home, he wears a dressing gown over his clothes and a sleeping bag. The public warming spaces also set up in churches and libraries come in different shapes and sizes. And some of them also provide food, hot drinks, and internet access. Daniel Andrews, partnership manager at Wandsworth Library, said that since becoming a warm bank, the site had recorded an increase in visitors. A parent at Wandsworth Library told The National they were visiting with their child to keep warm. She said, "We are here because outside is very cold and there is no space where you can stay with a little child." Warm Welcome, a campaign group offering people warm spaces in their local areas, says that they are determined to equip and support thousands of free, warm and welcoming spaces in communities across the UK. Warm Welcome's website says, "We believe everyone should have a warm and welcoming space to go to this winter, which is why our network of community organisations, churches, libraries, businesses and other faith groups across the UK have opened their doors to provide exactly that." David Barclay, manager of the Warm Welcome campaign, called it unacceptable that people are being forced to decide whether to heat their homes or eat. Many UK organizations have cautioned that thousands of people with low incomes are at risk during the extreme low temperatures hitting the UK, as average energy bills are twice as higher than they were this time last year. According to YouGov's newly released data, only one in six Britons, about 18%, said that they had the heating on and that it was both as hot as they like and on for as long as they like. The think tank Institute for Government defines the UK's cost of living crisis as the fall in real disposable incomes that is adjusted for inflation and after taxes and benefits that the UK has experienced since late 2021. The UK's and Europe's energy crisis has been building up over the past year as increased demand during the post-COVID reopening of economies coincided with Russia's special operation in Ukraine and a subsequent squeeze on gas supplies into Europe. We'll be right back.
The WeForum.org writes, warm banks are spaces where people can go to heat up for free if they can't afford to turn on the heating in their home this winter. They have been organized by charities, councils and community groups across the UK to help people struggling with the surging cost of energy. Over 50% of councils in England and Wales are involved in setting up warm banks or supporting groups who are doing so. Warm banks operate on the same principle as food banks, which help people who can't afford to feed themselves or their families. More than 3,000 warm banks are listed on the website of the Warm Welcome campaign, which is organizing community responses to the cost of living crisis. Birmingham, the UK's second biggest city, has a network of hundreds of warm banks opening up. Fred Ratley, a coordinator of the Birmingham Poverty Truth Commission, told the local news website, "There was talk of 8, then 100. Now we think there will be hundreds." London, Glasgow and Bristol are among the many other major UK cities with warm banks, and the hashtag warm banks and warm hubs are being used widely on Twitter to help people find places to keep warm. The UK raised its energy price cap by 80% on October 1st. The energy price cap is the maximum rate a supplier can charge for their default tariffs. The increase means the average gas and electricity bill for a UK household will jump to $4,228 a year, from $2,349. The surge is largely a result of gas prices rising to record levels because of the Ukraine-Russia conflict. But higher energy costs aren't the only extra financial burden facing households. Inflation, as measured by the Consumer Prices Index, is running at above 10%, meaning average weekly shopping bills are more expensive too. Some people's mortgage payments are also rising substantially because of repeated jumps in interest rates. And rental costs are rising at their highest rate on record as landlords pass on increased mortgage payments. The Guardian Daily reports Scotland's leading anti-poverty campaigners are urging councils and communities not to repeat past mistakes by allowing warm banks for those unable to afford heating their homes over the winter months to become as entrenched as food banks. The plea was made in a joint statement from the Poverty Alliance, Trussell Trust Scotland and the Syrenians, that cautions that emergency responses to escalating fuel poverty, however well-intentioned, risk shifting the focus away from government responsibility to ensure all citizens are able to heat their homes. The notion of warm banks first entered wider discussions about the cost of living crisis in July when it was raised by the consumer rights campaigner Martin Lewis. He suggested libraries and other public buildings could become the equivalent of food banks, where people who can't afford heating are invited to spend their days at no cost with heating. Since then, a number of councils across the UK, including in Bristol, Dundee and Aberdeen, have confirmed they are considering such measures. Recently, Scotland's largest local authority, Glasgow City Council, voted unanimously for green proposals to create a network of welcome places, which will offer welfare advice and refreshments, as well as a warm, dry venue. But those on the front line of fuel poverty are worried these efforts, though intended as a last resort, could normalize the experience rather than challenging governments to act. Peter Kelly, the director of the Poverty Alliance, told The Guardian, "Of course, we appreciate why these warm spaces are being set up, and they will be a lifeline for some, but it entrenches the idea that the welfare state is peripheral and contingent." Compare this to food banks. They were supposed to be an emergency response to austerity, and now we have an established and sophisticated network across the country.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.